This is an ABC podcast.
G'day, Tom Switzer here, and thank you for joining me on Between the Lines, on air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. Always great to have your company. Now, today on the program, dictators. 20th century history is littered with them. Hitler, Stalin, Mao Zedong, how did they get there? And more alarmingly, how did they stay in their positions of power? And what do they all have in common? Later, author Frank DeCutter, he joins me to explain. But first, have you ever wondered why we in Australia have not witnessed nativist movements that won power? The kind of insurgency forces that have proliferated across Europe and the US in recent years. Sure, we've had One Nation, and of course we've had Clive Palmer, but we've not had a Trump, have we? Nor have we had a so-called Brexit moment. Why? Why do you think Australia has been immune to this so-called populist explosion? And are we due for one? Sam Roggeveen is author of Our Very Own Brexit, Australia's Hollow Politics and Where It Could Lead Us. He's the director of the Lowy Institute's International Security Program, and the publication is a Lowy Institute paper. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Now, before we deal with Australia, answer this. How do you account for the success of nativist movements abroad?
Well, to answer that, let me first tell you about how I think not to explain it. So I think there's been, among commentators, a lot of slightly desperate reaching for analogies with the 1930s. This idea that Europe is drifting rightward, that there's a decreasing tolerance towards immigrants, an increasing attraction towards far-right figures and so on. I think that explanation is overblown. First of all, it doesn't account for various inconvenient facts like the fact that Emmanuel Macron won comfortably in France, the fact that the Greens Party in Germany is doing incredibly well. There are other examples. In the US too, I mean, Donald Trump is seen as the sort of harbinger of far-right populism, but he was far from the most right-wing candidate that the Republicans offered. So I don't think that really explains it. So here's my explanation. First of all, populist sentiment may not actually be on the rise in Europe. Populist parties and right-wing populist parties definitely are. But I think the factor that all these European countries have in common, and actually Australia has it too, and we can get onto that, is the fact that the big centre-right and centre-left parties, the mainstream traditional parties on the centre-right and centre-left, are all in decline. They're all going backwards in vote share, and they're all going backwards in membership. So what happens when these parties become weaker is that they used to be able to contain or co-opt or suppress that kind of far-right sentiment, that populist sentiment. But as they get weaker, that vote, that share of the vote, is essentially liberated. So my argument is not that right-wing populist sentiment is on the rise in Europe. My argument is simply that that share of the vote has always existed. That sentiment has always existed. It's merely been liberated by the decline of the mainstream
parties. And certainly if you look at France and Italy, the two main parties have virtually disappeared. I mean, in 2017, in the French presidential election in the second round, but neither the Conservatives nor the Socialists made it to the final round. But in Britain, though, Sam, at the last general election, 2017, the Tories and Labour, they scored their highest combined vote share since 1970, 85%. So does that contradict your thesis?
It makes my thesis a little harder. My explanation for that is actually that this is a reasonable outcome from what I would simply call increased volatility among voters. So the broad trend around Europe, and as I say, it's happening in Australia as well, is that the big centre-left and centre-right parties are in decline. And what happens when that vote becomes less tied to the major parties is that it can go anywhere. So in various European countries, it's gone to right-wing populists. As I said, in Germany, for instance, a lot of it's gone to the Greens as well. And then I think once these parties get tested, and often they're found wanting, these new parties, then the vote can drift back. It's happened in Greece recently as well, where the Syriza populist left-wing party won office twice, won two consecutive elections, and has now been thrown out, and one of the old centre-right parties has been put back into power.
Talk about Brexit, the original Brexiteers, of course, and you identify this in your book, are the Eurosceptic Tories. Mm. Now, on this program, over the years, we've had many Brexiteers on the right, Daniel Hannan, Simon Heffer, Isabel Oakeshott, Fraser Nelson, among others. And they say that the Brexit vote in 2016 was a cry for liberty, Sam. They say that Britain has not had a Trump moment. It has not embraced protectionism or nativism. Rather, they want their politicians to try to manage globalisation and control borders better than the EU has been doing from Brussels. Mm. So to the extent that that is true, is it wrong to define Brexit as a form of a nativist movement?
I agree with parts of that analysis. I wouldn't tie the Brexit vote too closely to immigration, for example, simply because there's opinion polling, which I quote in the book, which shows that, in fact, Brits have become quite dramatically warmer towards immigration and feel that immigration is making a major contribution to British society over the years of
these
Brexit
Tory
disaster.
Brexiteers will say that John Howard was right. They want Britain to be like Australia. That is, we'll decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come.
Well, where I agree with them is that, like I said, I wouldn't tie it so closely to immigration, but I would tie it to the idea of control. Mm. And basically, I think what happened inside the Tory party that led to the 2016 referendum is essentially that the Eurosceptic faction of the Tory party became so powerful in a party that was overall much weaker, became so powerful that David Cameron, the Prime Minister, felt it was impossible to resist them and he had to allow the referendum. Now, at the time, I quote in the book, in 2010, when David Cameron first came to power, the grand percentage total of the number of people in that year who thought relations with Europe was Britain's biggest challenge was 1%. So nobody cared. This referendum, when it was announced, fell upon a completely indifferent public. Mm. But when they were asked to vote on it, they, I think, came to a judgment that the Europe project, capital letters project, that both major parties had pursued, was running ahead of where they were. So the Europe project was really an elite project run by Britain's both major parties. And the public, when it was asked, took the opportunity to say, hang on, this has gone a little bit too far.
My guest is Sam Roggeveen, and he's the author of Our Very Own Brexit. It's a Lowy Institute paper. Sam, let's bring this to Australia. Why do you think we've been largely immune to this kind of populist disruption that's upended political establishments in Washington, in London, it's in the process of doing so in London, and in many parts of the continent?
Well, first of all, we haven't been immune from the decline of major parties. So at the 2019 election, the primary vote of both our major parties went down, and the overall trend has been downward now for several decades. At least since the 1980s, and it affects the Labor Party in particular, which is down now in the low 30s.
This is your point. Australian politics is increasingly hollow.
Australian politics is increasingly hollow because the public has pulled away from the major parties, which are the major force in our parliament, inevitably, because of, I think, the voting system cements their place at the centre of our politics. So, yes, politics has become hollow because the political parties are still there at the centre of it, but the public no longer cares about the major parties.
And how precisely has the decline of Australia's two parties produced a different kind of instability?
Well, in Australia over the last decade, we've seen a huge turnover in prime ministers, for instance. We've seen very close election results, two periods of minority government. We've even seen governments withdrawing legislation because they couldn't get their own side to support
it. Is that really so different, though? Because from Federation in 1901 until the outbreak of World War One, Australia had 10 prime ministerships. At the height of the Vietnam War, from 66 to 72, we had 6 prime ministers. Even Bob Hawke, Australia's greatest Labor Prime Minister, was knifed in a party coup. So, given all this history, listeners might think that political churn, far from being the aberration, is the political norm. Sam?
Yes, reasonable point. And if this the crisis that I'm talking about, that I describe in my book, was confined purely to leadership changes, then I think you'd have a really strong case. But what we see in Europe is that actually these political changes, the decline of the major parties, goes on despite leadership stability. Angela Merkel's been in charge for 14 years in Germany, and yet the main opposition party in Germany now is the AfD, which is a party that didn't even exist when Merkel came to office.
But how precisely has the churn of Australia's leaders really hurt living standards and our way of life? Because we've still had 28 years of uninterrupted growth. We have, by all accounts, a very successful, non-discriminatory, large-scale immigration policy.
Yep.
And frankly, we do lack the kind of polarisation that you see in Westminster and Washington.
Yep, we do. And I think the reason why we haven't had our moment of reckoning with this hollowing out of politics is precisely because we haven't gone into recession and our political class has behaved fairly responsibly. I think perhaps the other factor here is that we haven't yet had a really talented leader, political leader, that comes from outside the major party tradition. So I think what's required to maybe break this system open, a system that is more brittle than we think it is, the duopoly, it requires a political leader with money and with talent. And let me put it this way, Tom. I think Clive Palmer had one of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. What about, I mean, there is a school of thought that you deal with in your book about how normal programming has resumed since Scott Morrison's surprise victory on May 18. And to be fair, isn't leadership churn now less likely in Canberra, given that both major parties have made it more difficult to topple leaders?
Yes, it absolutely is. So the leadership churn will now, if not stop, then it will slow down because it's become much more difficult to topple leaders, as you say. But as I was just pointing out, these changes, wholesale changes really, to the party political establishment are happening in Europe despite leadership stability. I mentioned Germany. Similar thing in the Netherlands. You've had the Dutch Prime Minister now going into its 10th year, yet he has led three different governments. The first one involved the Greens. The latest one involves the centre-right Christian Democrats. So these big shifts in the party political settlement that we have in Australia can occur even despite leadership stability.
Your thesis, political dysfunction, that could see Australia make a break with our geography. Now, you say one of our main political parties, in desperation, could exploit an issue that ties Australia to Asia, and the issue is immigration. Tell us more.
Yeah, so what I'm arguing is that the hollowing out of our politics could become so extreme that one of the parties actually takes a desperate measure, which is essentially what happened to the Tory party in Britain, right? It took a desperate measure to put to the people this idea of breaking away from Europe. Mm. One of our major parties could make a similar decision to break Australia away from Asia.
And that could have cross-party appeal.
Perhaps it could,
like Brexit,
yes.
Did.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So,
But don't the Lowy Institute polls show relatively strong support for both globalisation and immigration?
Yes, indeed. So, and what I'm talking about is not that there's a public groundswell against immigration at all. And as I said earlier, there was no groundswell of opposition to Europe either in Britain. It was a phenomenon. It was a thing that was cooked up inside one of the two major parties because they were worried about their electoral decline in the face of UKIP, the Nigel Farage party, and also because the leadership was worried about a restive Eurosceptic backbench.
And your point is that a recession or a big disruptive moment in Australia's development could allow some group to exploit immigration as an issue.
Well, that's a possible trigger, yeah. But I mean, I don't think Britain was going into recession.
No, that's true.
So my point is really that it's the decline of the parties themselves that may cause them to get desperate.
Now, after the Christchurch massacre in March, the media conventional wisdom, and this was often the refrain on shows like 7:30 and Q&A, it suggested that our nation's entrenched racism, these are the ABC's words, fuels Islamophobia and extreme right-wing violence. Is that your understanding of Australian public discourse?
No, nope, not at all. And I don't think the public opinion polling really reflects it. I mean, I don't deny the major racial problem that Australia has. We in particular have major unfinished business with our Indigenous people. And I always like Waleed Ali's formulation that Australia has high levels of low-level racism. So that's definitely a blight on our society. But I don't think it's an idle boast that Malcolm Turnbull used to make, that we are one of the most successful multicultural nations on earth.
Well, to the extent that that is true, doesn't that then make it difficult for a mainstream political leader to exploit immigration? Or would they be exploiting immigration in the sense that there are genuine public concerns about, say, infrastructure bottlenecks in Sydney and Melbourne?
Well, it could be that, but I mean, you could have made the same argument about Britain and Brexit. You know, you could have said the British people are far too tolerant of immigrants and far too racially tolerant to ever subscribe to this idea of breaking from Europe. You could also say the same thing about Germany. I mean, the opinion polling shows, in fact, that Germany has not become less tolerant of immigrants or of other cultures. And yet they have this rising far-right party. So what I'm arguing, again, is that this is not public sentiment. What this is a slow breakdown of the party political sentiment, which ends up having outsized consequences.
The book is called Our Very Own Brexit. It's a Lowy Institute paper. Sam, it's great to have you on the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Sam Roggeveen is director of the Lowy Institute's International Security Program. You're an RN.
Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Have you read or heard about all those books lamenting the crisis of Western democracy? Here's just a sample in the last year or so. How Democracies Die, How Democracies End, The Death of Democracy, Fascism, A Warning, and so on. The headline of a recent edition of the prestigious Foreign Affairs magazine simply read, Autocracy Now. But is all this talk about the fall of democracy and the resurgence of dictatorship, is all that talk overstated? I mean, how do the Putins, the Xi Jinpings, the Erdogans, the Orbans, the Dutertes, how do they compare with the dictators of the 20th century? Frank DeCutter is author of How to Be a Dictator. It examines the cults and propaganda surrounding 20th century dictators. Frank's been in Australia as a guest of the Jaipur Literary Festivals in Perth and Adelaide. Frank, welcome to Australia.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you select 8 case studies. We're talking from Hitler and Stalin to Mao Zedong and Kim Il-sung in North Korea, and a few lesser-known dictators such as Mengistu from Ethiopia, who I must confess I'd never heard of. Why did you choose these 8 unique individuals?
Well, I'm not keen to come up with a broad sociological overview. In fact, what strikes me so much with dictators, as well as with other people, of course, including members of my family and my wife, is that they are unique individuals. So to try to group them into some sort of typology, I think, is misguided. Ultimately, dictators are unique individuals who operate in unique circumstances. So the very best you could do is to pick a number to illustrate that huge diversity, from Hitler in a reasonably developed country like Germany in the 1920s and 30s, all the way to Duvalier, Papa Doc in Haiti, a very small, impoverished half island, not to mention Mengistu in Ethiopia. And of course, all the big dictators are there, but also smaller ones to give you a good sense of that extraordinary diversity. Yet underneath all of it, there is something that they have in common, namely that they are determined to concentrate power in their own hands or in the hands of one party state. And this is the distinction with rising democracies throughout the 20th century, where they really clash, so to speak. There are countries that try, hard as it may be, to separate out powers, build up an independent judicial system, have checks and balances, and then there are those who try to concentrate all powers in the hands of one individual or one party.
Yeah, and these dictators, they come to power in obviously dramatically different circumstances, but there are commonalities in terms of consolidating power, right?
Well, very much. Of course, the issue here in the 20th century is that we live in an age of democracy. So these dictators, paradoxically, are rather weak. They refuse to go to the ballot box or have open elections. They actually take a shortcut. They seize power by organizing a coup or by rigging the system. But of course, if you seize power through violence, you must continue to use violence to maintain your power. Somebody else could take it from you in turn. So there is an almost inescapable descent into violence, as you must crush all your enemies and friends alike.
Your thesis revolves around this notion of a personality cult. So how does that personality cult take hold and sustain itself with these dictators?
Well, as much as you must instill fear in those who surround you and fear in the population, it's much better if you can compel your own population to create the illusion of consent, if you can coerce them into pretending that they actually adore you and that you have their support. In other words, you must turn everyone into a liar who will acclaim you, recite your work, praise your genius, and never dare to say anything in public against you. In short, the cult of personality turns people into liars and makes them true captives in the mind of this dictatorship. It's all about self-censorship and, in turn, censorship of others.
And that personality cult can ultimately fail to resonate with your people. I mean, you obviously dedicate a chapter to Ceaușescu, the Romanian communist dictator from the 60s to 1989. I mean, his fall is rather dramatic and sudden. Let's go back 30 years ago, 1989. Here's an account of Ceaușescu's fall from grace. This is from the History Channel.
On the 21st of December, Ceaușescu returned to Bucharest and called a vast rally. He had lost touch with reality and believed that by one personal appearance, he could turn the clock back. A last-minute offer to increase pensions by a few pennies did nothing to help. The momentum of revolution was now unstoppable. The hired party hacks at the front clapped as usual, but the rest of the crowd began to heckle and boo him. The banners, which had for so long proclaimed support for his tyranny, would do so no more.
That's the History Channel looking at 30 years ago. Now, the Romanian army abandoned the dictator. They joined the people. The revolution was triumphant. And a few days later, Ceaușescu and his wife were shot dead. I think it was at a toilet block, Frank. Christmas 1989. Frank Decutter.
Absolutely. Lined up against a shabby toilet block and shot. His wife's last words, Elena Ceaușescu, were F-U-C-K-U, right. If that's still allowed on your radio.
So much for the personality cult then.
Well, exactly. The point you have to understand is that for more than 20 years, this man had been able to coerce his population to acclaim him. So, of course, you have party hacks who will applaud him every time he goes to the countryside, when there are mass meetings, inaugurations of public projects, you name it. But there are also loudspeakers in the back that produce the sounds required, the sounds of approval required. So this man veers off into a world of his own, surrounded by sycophants and liars, and fails to understand what is happening on the 21st of December 1989. His voice falters, and at that very moment, ordinary people know the spell is broken, the fear is gone, and the revolution starts. So many other dictators veer off into a world of their own, teetering somehow between hubris on the one hand and paranoia on the other.
The book is called How to Be a Dictator, and the author is Frank Decutter, and he's been in Australia as a guest of Literary Festivals in Perth and Adelaide. Incidentally, Frank, I noticed you neglect to profile any 20th century dictators from the Arab world. I'm thinking of the Saddam Husseins, the Gaddafis, Bashar al-Assad's father, among others. Why?
Well, I had a long list and I had a short list. There's really that much you can do. You have to realize that the book is, you might think the book is based on secondary sources, but it's not. There's a lot of original research in there. The entire chapter of Duvalier is based on archival documents. I'm one of very few to write about Mengistu using Amharic sources. I had somebody in Ethiopia help me with that. So there's a lot of primary research that goes into it. And just to add yet another chapter on Gaddafi, who I did have in mind, but who knows, there might be a volume two.
Well, leaving aside Kim Jong-un, why are we unlikely to witness the kind of dictatorships of the 20th century?
Well, it's a very good question. Of course, you should never say no. Democracy, the good old saying, eternal vigilance is always required. But ultimately, if Stalin were to be resurrected or Adolf Hitler were to be resurrected, I think they would scoff at the very people who think they are autocrats. Stalin would not have a lot of respect for Putin. The only true countries, regimes that have managed to keep power concentrated in their own hands and will strike mercilessly at any attempt to divide it are, of course, North Korea, with the third generation of the Kim Il-sung family, and, of course, the People's Republic of China, where Xi Jinping is in a direct line of descent with Mao Zedong. These are the same institutions, the same people, the same slogans, the same ideology, and the same stubborn refusal to separate out powers and have an independent judicial system.
Yeah, well, some beg to differ. A year ago, I chatted with Benjamin Carter Hitt. He's the author of The Death of Democracy, The Rise of Hitler, and I asked him if he drew any analogies between Weimar Germany in the 1930s and the US and Europe today.
One of the things I am worried about now in our time, in the United States and in other countries, is precisely that complacency. You know, in countries that have been democracies for a long time, I think many of us think this system is settled and it's been around forever and the institution will protect us. But the thing is, the institution doesn't run by itself. The institution runs on human beings. And if citizens don't act aggressively to check that, then the thing will run along towards a bad outcome. You see this, I think complacency about democratic stability is actually a real danger when you have people who do want to subvert the system.
Benjamin Carter Hett, author of The Death of Democracy, that was on Between the Lines a year ago. Frank DeCutter.
Well, yes, of course, one shouldn't be complacent. It goes back to what I said about eternal vigilance. But to compare parts of Europe, or all of Europe, or all of the United States to Nazi Germany in the 1930s is really displaying a crass ignorance of historical processes, but also somehow trivializes the many millions of people, tens of millions of people in Europe and elsewhere who were the victims of these dictatorships. I think there is a point that can be made about de-democratization, but it's not quite the same as a dictatorship. De-democratization is a process by which democratic institutions are being very gradually undermined. Yet even in the case of Putin, this is far from a dictatorship. If Putin is undermining the independent judicial system, it's because he has an independent judicial system. If he tries to get rid of separation of powers, it's because it's written into the constitution. If he interferes with elections, it's because there are elections. Look at Turkey with Erdogan, also, of course, decried as a dictator and a very unpleasant man indeed. But could you imagine Adolf Hitler or Xi Jinping today or Kim Jong-un allowing an opposition leader to be elected as the mayor of their capital? I think it's a very distant dream, certainly for people in Hong Kong who look across the border at the PRC. That's where the dictatorships are.
And yet Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, her book is called Fascism, a Warning. And I've been struck that, Frank, ever since Donald Trump's election in 2016, we've witnessed, you know, media, academic panic about looming fascism across the United States. But surely the checks and balances built into the US Constitution, they restrain the president, right?
Well, I think you see democracy in action right now with attempts to impeach him. The whole point surely is that there is a very simple test to find out whether there's a dictatorship or not. This goes back to the subtitle of my book, The Cult of Personality. Pick your country, travel there, and find out if people are willing to openly, publicly criticize their leader. Now, I think chances are if you fly to Washington, there will be no dearth of individuals critical of the man in charge. I defy you to get on that plane and go to North Korea or Beijing and do the same thing. Mm. In fact, we have a National Baseball Association that is openly critical of the President of the United States. And so they should be. We all should be critical. Yet kneels down in front of Xi Jinping to apologize for having hurt the feelings of the Chinese people. This is on American soil. So now you know where your dictator is.
Yeah, well, the Washington Post masthead, it says, democracy dies in darkness. And your point, Frank, is that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, as power can easily be stolen. It's all true, but vigilance is not the same as gloom. A reminder how history teaches us a sense of perspective. Frank, wonderful to have you on the program.
Thank you, sir.
Frank DeCutter is author of How to Be a Dictator, The Cult of Personality in the 20th Century. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Between the Lines. Always great to have your company. Remember, if you've missed past episodes of the program, just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Between the Lines. Let's chat next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.